You are listening to Talking Machines. I'm Catherine Gorman.
And I'm Neil Lawrence.
And today, Neil, I'd love to go back to a conversation that we were having a couple of episodes ago about frequentists and Bayesians and their generations-long fight to rule Westeros.
It is like Westeros. It's like, you know, we're on book five. What's going to happen next? We don't know. We have to write a new TV series, and we don't even have the book to run from. So what we were mainly talking about last time was the sort of history, and I do think history is super important. You know, I can't remember dates, as we'll know. I think I said that Bayes was 1776 or something, or, you know, which was some other, I can't even remember what happened in 1776. I'm not good at dates, but I do love the themes of history and the rhythm of history and how it leads on to the next thing. And so a lot of the context of this Bayesian frequentist debate in machine learning, I think, comes from that history. What I wanted to do was sort of talk a little bit about in machine learning where I think we are in terms of what's really going on, because I think a lot of that history, it's interesting contextually, but perhaps less important for what we do. I don't think we really split into Bayesians and frequentists in machine learning at all, not in the classical defined sense. And I should say I'm about 10 years out of date, because now we're all back to being connectionists and just doing neural networks. But for the 10-year history up to now, I think that what went on across the period where people became very interested in graphical models and convex optimization and kernel machines, which was the period when I entered the field in 96, when I came in because of neural networks, and then I was, you know, turned into someone who was interested in variational methods, Gaussian processes, probabilistic methods, a bit of graphical models. The way I would characterize certainly that period is characterize it as a split into one group that was interested in optimization of objective functions, which is, I think, what people think of as the frequentist, because they would then tend to prove properties about their solution, which is similar to a frequentist type idea. And another group were doing probabilistic modeling. Now, I want to, in a future episode, come back to what I think of as the difference between model and algorithm, but let's just talk about as a sort of entity and why is that different. And these were thought of as the Bayesians. It's not really Bayesian to model something probabilistically. That anyone's allowed to do that. You don't have to have the license, or the police can't turn up, or whatever. Philosophical difference, which is when you formulate the problem you're interested in as an optimization problem, you often looks like you're trying to formulate the thing you're interested in directly. We talk about a cost function. So there's an implication even that there's sort of a monetary value associated with what you're doing. So I'm writing down the cost I'll pay if I get things wrong. That seems very sensible. That's sort of the direct thing. That's what the frequentist type group that I don't really think of exactly as frequentists would tend to do. Formulate as an optimization problem. And then they would typically relax it. Classic example of this is L1 regularization. So L1 regularization, or lasso as it sort of became known in the stats community, but it sort of around a bit before that as well, sparse modeling, what people were really interested in doing is counting the number of parameters that were non-zero and then regularizing according to that. Now, that unfortunately leads to a very non-convex, difficult optimization problem. And L1 is very often justified by what's called a relaxation of that optimization problem. So great researchers like Francis Bark, a lot of what they'll do is sort of say, well, I really want to do this one, but I can relax to this interesting optimization problem that's L1. Then that's convex. Convexity of optimization, very important. So convex, there's one solution. You can prove things about that solution, and you may well attempt to prove how it relates to the thing you really wanted to optimize. So you have some sort of thing that you wanted to optimize, and you relax away to something else. And that's a really great philosophy. And a lot of the people, if you look at support vector machine work, it's formulated broadly in that way, not always even relaxing the optimization, but sometimes doing so, but getting a good convex optimization and then proving lots of things mathematically about it. The apparent Bayesian approach, which I would say is not Bayesian, it's just probabilistic modeling, is quite different, because there's the main doctrine of the Church of Bayes is that you can separate problems of inference and decision. So inference, I mean in terms of Bayesian inference, we talked about that a few weeks ago, not the statistical or inferencing in neural networks, statistical inference. So the process of inference being build your probabilistic model, understand what's going on in the world, put probability distributions over all the variables you're interested in, and now, once you've done all that, you can then ask questions of the decision by interrogating the probabilities. And what is known to be true is if your probabilistic model is correct, you can separate these and you will still perform optimally. You know, lots of computer science is about separating a challenge into distinct parts, and this is a lovely separation. I can think about the system as much, or I can sit there with my sort of, you know, smoking a pipe or whatever I do to think, and then building my model, and then later on, people can turn up and I interrogate my model, and it will give all the answers. You know, it'd be a wonderful, great AI. The challenge there is that these challenges of intractability in integration of the probabilistic model in defining the model, the sort of models you can dream up, very few of them are actually tractable. So you end up with an enormous amount of work on sampling and approximate inference. But then people forget that actually your model probably wasn't correct, and it's wrong to have separated the pros. So that's the doctrine. The doctrine is the doctrine of model correctness. I see a lot of very naive stuff. I shouldn't say this. I'm going to get myself in trouble. Written by quite sophisticated authors about this, because I don't think they've really thought about this. You know, that actually that is the issue with that type of modeling. It's not so much Bayesian itself. That's the issue of separating model and decision. That's certainly characteristic of who we talk about as Bayesians in machine learning. Now, like many, many things, neither of these is absolutely correct, because you can come up with circumstances where both strategies fail. So, of course, you're in a French bakery and you're selling croissants. You need to decide how many croissants you're going to put in the oven. And you've got to make a prediction of how many you're going to sell that day. Now, for some weird reason, you pay a quadratic cost. I've never understood how you can ever pay a quadratic cost. Like, you know, so you sell out of croissants and people come in and want to buy them and you don't have them. That's
opportunity cost.
Yes. It seems linear. It seems linear in the amount of money you make. But okay, let's say it's quadratic for some reason. That makes the math easier later. That might be the reason. Or you have too many croissants and they spoil and now you've wasted. This is actually an asymmetric cost, interestingly. Mm-hmm. You can actually define these costs very well. But so whatever you make it, linear, quadratic, whatever, you can now write down the function you want to optimize in terms of your previous data, because you can see exactly how much you pay. So you can sort of fit that model in that way. And that's what these optimization orientated people would advocate doing. But there's something really odd about that, because if the demand for the croissants is what we might call, let's say you did use the quadratic loss, the demand is heavy-tailed. Mm-hmm. So if the demand is, by heavy-tailed, it means like day-to-day, you can get quite extreme values. So like one day it's 7, the next day it suddenly drops to like 0 because it rains or something.
Yeah.
And then the next day it's 8, and then it's 9, and then it's like 50 because there's a concert in town and they're all waking up and they're coming past. Just talk about the loss function. We haven't talked about the prediction function. That's one of my favorite dualities. There's two functions, the prediction function, the loss function. So you've got the prediction function right, we're assuming. But if you've got the loss function wrong and you fit it by what's so-called empirical risk minimization, minimizing this cost, then you will get overly affected. You'll have a quadratic error on these large values and you'll get overly affected by them. You'll be drawn to them. What you're much better off doing is fitting the probabilistic model that understands that loss and ignores. So if you look at probabilistic model, the in inverted commas loss, and this is a sloppy thing people do, that call it loss, the log likelihood that you fit will not cause a very high cost for these outliers. So you're better fitting off the probabilistic model. So the Bayesian's right. So good old Bayesian, or Bayesian, what we call the Bayesian, the probabilistic model is right. They don't need to be necessarily doing this in a Bayesian way for this to be true. But having said that, that's if the model is correct. If on the other hand, you can certainly construct situations, let's take a sort of situation with very high asymmetric costs. So cancer versus not cancer. And you know that the diagnosis of cancer, an incorrect clearing of a clean health when the patient has cancer is a very, very high cost. But perhaps sending them on for further tests is low cost. That's the classic sort of asymmetric cost. A Bayesian trying to fit a linear model to some data like that, where the data itself is not linear. You have to sort of picture this in your head. You've got perhaps two clusters of non-cancer, but in between them you've got a cancer cluster. So as I go from left to right, I have non-cancer, then I have cancer, then I have non-cancer. Now a Bayesian can't fit a linear model to this. If you fit this probabilistically, you won't get a good result. Your linear model will just go straight through the cancer bit and classify half of them as cancer, half of them as non-cancer. You can't fix this up by your decision making later, because you had the wrong model. And this is really, you always have the wrong model. You never have the right model unless you generated the data from that model, which is why we often do that to show nice results. But if someone's actually taking costs into account, what they could do is they could put the decision boundary to either the right or the left of the cancer cluster, correctly classify all the positive cancer patients as having cancer and half of the non-cancer patients as having cancer. Pay the cost for sending those half for testing, but save all the people in the middle if you're taking into account this asymmetric loss when you're fitting your model. So two aspects to this. One, it's vital to consider your data generating process if you make croissants. But then two, if you're resolving cancer, it's vital to consider, or you will get better performance if you consider the cost of your misclassification at model fitting time. So neither of these camps is entirely correct. And they can both learn from each other and once again live in perfect harmony. And again, we get quite blinkered because we're looking at just the small problems just in front of us. But I think if you're going to be effective as a data scientist or a deployer of machine learning, and we talk about consumers of machine learning versus generators of machine learning, you want to know these broad lessons. Mm-hmm. You want to be like, oh my God, I'm a Bayesian. I have to dislike all that other stuff there. Or, oh, I do empirical risk minimization. You have to understand the weaknesses and strengths. We basically don't have the right answer, right? We don't know the way to do everything. You need to know when to deploy each one, what the weaknesses of each one are, and what the advantages of each one are.
Well, if you want to learn even more about Bayesian frequentists and croissant making, you can visit our website, thetalkingmachines.com. So our question this week on Talking Machines is about ethics. Working as a data scientist, I get to work on some pretty cool projects. However, one recent project proposal I wrote made me question where the boundaries between what we are capable of doing with data science and what is ethical to do with data science are. We are quite concerned about what AI and computers might do if they get smart enough to trick us. However, I don't think enough people like to discuss what people can do with AI to manipulate others. So, Neil, this is sort of the question that I think about a lot. What are the ethical implications right now that we need to be thinking about and working towards changing?
I think that's a great question. And I really am a great believer in all of us working in this area needing to think about this a lot and more. And why? Well, because any technology that is disruptive could take things in good ways or bad ways, and you want to make it as good as possible. But in particular with this sort of technology that we're looking at, the tools to fix things will also come from the same community. So we have to be very conscious of that. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking in particular of areas like fairness, accountability, transparency, learning, FatML that Hannah Wallach is one of the figures behind, many other people, privacy-aware learning. One of the thoughts in my head is that if the machine learning tools, it may not be totally true, that one of the few technologies that is now forcing the accumulation of data into one place is machine learning. It's other technologies, such as database technologies, no longer do that. They can be distributed. And the last remaining thing that causes people to need to bring data together is to do the machine learning side. And I just have a sense that once the data is together in one place, then that's perhaps where things get a little bit more dangerous. So if we're the community that's forcing that in order to gain all these valuable insights out, then I think the onus is on us also to come up with ways of dealing with that. Now, having said that, you know, the potential benefits are extraordinary. And the ethical questions are very complex because there's some form of social contract, I suspect, with a lot of these deployments that we're doing. But what society wants is evolving, and what people want is evolving. I think the thing that worries me the most is when people think that they've got a single-shot solution for these problems. I think that's the thing I'm very suspicious of. It seems to me with any previous movement, with any previous sort of large social change, people, and this may not be a large social change, but if we look across revolutions in the past, the worst thing that happened was when people thought, oh, I've got really the solution. I know exactly how we do politics now, and I just have to implement it widely, you know, regardless of what other people think.
Right.
That seems, almost all forms of extremism seem to have some sense of that to them. And there's also there's a sense now that, oh, we can achieve this utopia if only we just work out the correct sense of morals or the correct sets of ethics, and we'll just have to deploy them across the world and everyone will live in harmony. But what if there isn't? And I'm not an expert on philosophy, but I think one of the things Kant has this categorical imperative, which is says there is some underlying correct set of models, and these, if that were true, then these things are true. But then all these odd things come out of it, which you certainly wouldn't want to apply across society. So it feels to me quite clear that you don't have a universal set of ideals that would apply for everyone. These are personal and subjective. And a very interesting thing as we deploy machine learning technologies is that Michael Littman at the Future of AI meeting I attended, a great meeting hosted by NYU over a year ago now, He talked about it as the big baby problem. His concern was, and I have a lot of sympathy for this point of view, the big fear is not some sort of artificial sentient beast that destroys us all. It's the fact that we can now deploy very rapidly things that affect many millions or billions of people's lives at one go. And if you do that clumsily, the sort of big baby wandering around New York is not actively trying to do anything. You know, I mean, when I say big here, I'm talking size of Empire State Building or something.
Right. Yeah, right. Yes. Baby Kong.
Baby Kong. He's not like King Kong where it's... Well, I don't know. King. I haven't seen the movie recently, not the classic. I don't know King Kong's motivation, so I shouldn't go there. One should never discuss motivations if you do. But in this envisaged baby, or Godzilla, the baby isn't actively trying to destroy humanity. It's just sort of large, clumsy stumbling around. And I thought that image from Michael was a very apt one for the sort of thing that we can blunder into very easily today. We have that capability. We have the capability to deploy at very, very large scale machine learning solutions. And the onus must be on those that are closest to it. I mean, there are issues about how quickly regulation can catch up, if regulation is indeed appropriate. So the onus has to be on the technologists, I believe. And at least some people, and what I'm very pleased to see is many people in the community do talk about it. And one of the things that's very exciting is the extent to which there's engagement between people from the legal profession, people from philosophy, like the NYU symposium, but also at NIPS, there have been many symposia on this area, social impacts of machine learning. I think that that's very encouraging to see, because I don't believe that any one of those community. I mean, last week we were talking about how geography affects diversity of thinking. Well, these are intellectual islands, law and computer science, you know. I find it fascinating when you discuss law and computer science together. A legal expert is actually trying to codify systems of behavior. And so you're trying to implement a code. A computer expert, computer scientist, is trying to implement code on a computer. So you think, well, this is the same thing. They're trying to implement systems, so it's the same. But it's totally different, because the computer scientist is trying to pin everything down extremely precisely, whereas the legal expert who's trying to codify in law systems of behavior is trying to leave in flexibility for, I mean, I perceive good laws last for a long time because there's an amount of flexibility perhaps in the language that allows things to evolve over time as society changes. Now, if we're going to codify law and ethics in our machine learning of today, then we've done it. It's rigid. We've put it in the baby. You know, I don't know. Now it's not a baby. I don't know. It's a philosophy professor or something.
Philosophy professors wrecking New York.
I mean, that seems potentially very problematic. It strikes me that what's lovely about humanity is the diversity of approaches people have. Mm-hmm. Okay, people comment on everyone else's behaviors and whatever, but the one thing you really want is diversity of approach. But the one thing that we're starting to see is very large-scale deployment of approaches, which necessarily are the same because they're computer code that has been widely distributed. To be fair, I don't lose a great deal of sleep over this, but there's many things you can worry about in the world. But I think it is something we should all be actively thinking about.
One of the questions around this that has always fascinated me, especially with regards to how fast we're developing these things and we're deploying them, or how fast the community is developing these tools and deploying them and using them, which I think is incredibly necessary. But regulation and law have generally always been reactive to situations. Something has to happen before something is done about it. Is there any sort of thinking that can be done that's proactive, or does that close doors that we haven't even passed through yet?
It's a very good question. I think I'm not an expert on law, but I thought a bit about this and sort of tried to think about how previous technologies were handled by regulation. I mean, it particularly, so living in Sheffield for a long time, an industrial area, and Manchester to the west, these are areas that experienced, you know, firsthand the first wave in the Industrial Revolution. Mm-hmm. You look at the disruption to people that occurred at the time and then some of the responses. But on the legal side, two things I thought about. Going back before then, you look at the printing press, which is a similarly disruptive technology. And, of course, up until the introduction of the printing press, copyright wasn't really very important, because a monk used to sit there in a chamber for, like, 5 years copying out the Bible, spending, like, 3 days on the letter G for God or something like that. I wasn't there, but you get the sense in which the value of writing the story was not as great as the value of copying it down. The amount of labor in the copying of the story, the creative process was therefore undervalued, or maybe it's overvalued today. And then you look at what's going on now. Well, that's being taken to the, you know, we can copy anything immediately. We don't even need printing presses. So copyright laws, how did they come about? When did they come about? I'm not entirely sure on the history of that, but if you look at then later patents, patents about intellectual property, capability to copy an idea and start manufacturing, a lot of this is about where is the value, who added the value, where's the credit gone? With patents, they were an evolution of something called a letters patent, which was a granting of a monopoly from, I think, a member of the royal family. King could grant you monopoly with a letters patent. And then so they took this legislation and they evolved it to apply for technology that you, here's your idea. And now I'm going to give you this letters patent to give you the right to own that idea because you were the first to come up with it. I think that what we should look at is existing legal mechanisms for starting. I'm a great believer that it's difficult to proactively regulate innovation because it's potentially stifling. But at the same time, you have to deal with the concerns. So I think law will typically lag. But what it's very because of this fact that the codification is flexible, not tight like in computer science, what you'll see is law that was initially there with one intent will evolve to take care of another, as copyright did for software. I have doubts about whether that worked particularly well or didn't, and certainly the open source movement has done wonderful things, and that's almost like trying to get rid of the copyright. But it'll take a while to work out, I suspect. The proactive, just, I'm not sure, maybe there are great examples, maybe the listeners know of good examples of proactive legislation. But the future is really, really difficult to envisage. I mean, sometimes people come up with examples. Oh, someone did look and they said it was like this. But actually, they don't talk about all the examples of where people didn't get it right. Trying to set law for the present, actually, is pretty hard to encourage the right forms of behavior. That's why we have a lot of lawyers around doing it. Trying to set law to the future, that just seems extremely difficult. I mean, there's some certain principles you can worry about. I worry a lot about privacy, individual privacy. I think that's something that should always be precious to us. And you wonder about giving back control of individuals to their data or something like that. I think things like that, general principles you can think about. But whether you can legislate, I once wrote something on an op-ed which was suggesting that the way you do it is something more like what we would call the highway code in the UK. You have in the States, it's called...
No, I don't know what that is.
It's the book you read before you take your driver's ed book.
Oh, yes.
So in the book, it says things. And one of the things it says, there's this difference between you must and you should. So it advises you, like it says, you should, I think for cycling, there's one of the things, it says something like, you should ride no more than two abreast. So you can ride two abreast, but you should no ride no more. That means it's not illegal for you to ride. They can't like arrest you or put you in prison or fine you.
For being free.
Yeah, for being three. But in the case of a civil liability case, then the responsibility will fall upon you for breaking the shoulds. So the should is not legal code. It's sort of best practice. But then the must is law. But then the highway code evolves. Like they're doing a new version for autonomous vehicles. Hmm. And I think that's an interesting way. You have it's not quite a living document, but you have a document. It's not a wiki. But you have a sort of document.
Not everyone can edit it.
Some debate, there's some group who worry about it. And like one time there was a red flag law, right, about the highways. But actually, you know, so there's an interesting case I wrote about where effectively the red flag law was slowing up steam traction engine. Someone overtook it and the steam traction engine turned into the carriage and two people were killed in the carriage.
Yeah.
Right, so it's one of those, oh, it seems a great idea, we'll just keep them going slow, then we'll be fine. Well, no, actually it's better to have mirrors and signaling and all these other things, because you know, the going slow didn't help there because it was holding up the horse and carriage and they tried to overtake.
Right.
So these are unperceived consequences of the obvious correct law. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't help anyone. Didn't help the lad that
the
was
carriage.
Killed. Yeah, yeah. And it didn't really help the steam traction engine trying to move its coal around. This was in Sheffield, actually, down a hill. You know, so I think, you know, obviously that law was removed and changed. And I'm not, you know, I'm a cyclist. So, you know, I would rather things were more biased towards cycles and would move back towards cycles. But you have that capability. It's negotiation. And I think that, you know, I don't know, some form of evolving legislation like that seems to me important. Not like the, we should have a new, Magna Carta for the internet or something like this. Because actually what people expect out of the internet now is very different today from what it was 15 years ago,
Oh, yeah. And if you had made the Magna Carta for the internet 15 years ago, you'd have all sorts of terrible growing pains as it becomes something different.
Yeah, what people, and I think these things stick around a long time, right? I think the 1850s or 60s, the law about the red flag, and I think they got rid of it in, 30 years later, something like that.
Oh my God, wow.
So, the consequences of your thinking, of your proactive legislation. But it's hard. But one interesting thing is, I think what's clever about having lots of different countries is they will try different things and some will work well and some will work less well. And of course, they'll copy from each other. Again, you need a diversity of approaches. I feel.
Well, I think we're seeing with the emergence of groups like the Partnership on AI and other philosophical, I don't know what I think of as think tank groups in this area. It's good to see people thinking formally about this. And I think that's really the only first step that we can take.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'd agree with that. I want people thinking informally. if you say formal thinking, it feels entrenched. I almost want people to be talking, chatting, understanding each other. But maybe at some point it needs to be formal, I suppose. It can't all be done in pubs.
If only it could, that would be so great.
Well, it always is, but the problem is you can't remember it the next day. That's the problem. Yep.
The catch-22 of thinking in pubs.
Yeah.
If you've got a question for Talking Machines, email us at thetalkingmachines@gmail.com or tweet us at TLKNGMCHNS. Our guest on this episode of Talking Machines is Ernest Mabaze, lecturer at the School of Computing at Makerere University in Kampala, Uganda. We began the interview with the same question we ask everyone, which is, how did you get where you are?
So I did engineering in undergraduate. I did engineering in Makerere University. And then after that, at that time, there was no course in computer science. We only had what are called flat courses. So you did computer science and math.
Some context, Makerere University is the main university in Uganda, and it's the most significant, is in the capital. Yeah.
Right. So Makerere ranks, I think, third in Africa right now.
It was in this sort of odd thing with Nairobi and what are the other ones? Kigali, these campuses, the University of London had these campuses in the capitals, and now these are all the separate universities. They're quite old. They're sort of.
Yeah, Makerere is really, really, really old. 97 years, I think,
or yeah.
A little bit more. So anyway, so at the time I joined university, I wanted to do computing, but there was no... So the closest thing to computing was a bachelor's course in electrical engineering. So I did that, and then after that, by the time I finished, there was a master's in computer science. So this was 1993, I think. And so after that, I did a master's in computer science, and then luckily I joined an NGO that was doing innovations in ICT. For health. And after that, I went back to the university to do research and PhD in the Netherlands. And then I came back. PhD was in machine learning. And then by that time, luckily, the ecosystem in Makerere University was ripe for sort of doing research in machine learning. We had John, who had just flown in, and he had really good ideas. And so
there's an interesting story there, isn't there? Because there's Barry Amoeba, who I've never met, but is the sort of visionary
behind this. Yeah, visionary guy who sort of had this idea of creating massive capacity in computing by training several number of PhDs. And so he brought in John. He kept bringing experts from out. His theory was really simple, bring in all the experts so they can build capacity locally. Part of it was this. John came and it was a good start.
Yeah, so John Quinn at the time, he just finished his PhD with Chris Williams in machine learning. But Barry Amoeba also got an entirely new building constructed for the department as well. I just find that so impressive.
That he did. He was a very dynamic man, yeah. He got this huge six-floor building in computing. It was something no one in the university had done, so the university was, buildings are normally structured and they're built by the university, but he's so almost single-handedly sort of lifted this building out of a huge project. It was quite impressive.
The challenge is that the traditional universities in Africa tend to be quite stuck in their ways. They have staff that have been around for a long time, just like all universities, but, you know, perhaps more extreme here. And that means that some of the larger universities are harder to sort of move in new directions. But the fact that the computer science department was new, that it wasn't there when you were an undergraduate, and, you know, has meant that Makerere has the advantage of being the most prestigious university in Uganda, but also very dynamic in its thinking around computer science, I feel, as an outsider.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was really a stroke of genius that Brian Reba was there, because he was a young man and he had done computing in Norway, I think. And when he came back, you know, he had so much energy that he built this young faculty. It was still the youngest faculty, the youngest school right now in Makerere University. And so it was just dynamic, and he sort of moved the needle from this old, you know, old institution and pushed it in a new direction with computing. And so this became phenomenal, how we grew the computing field in Uganda. But that was the thing. He had a lot of energy and the field was ripe, and Makerere was the place to sort of push this thing. Yeah.
And that, in some sense, is also becoming the engine for what's driving Data Science Africa now, because those are providing the foundations that are allowing the inspiration to shift locally to other institutions that can see what can be achieved, I think.
Yeah, we've provided a lot of examples. I mean, right now the School of Computing has, it's not a big number, but it's the biggest in East Africa, you know, 25 PhD holders in computing. And this has sort of driven a lot of research. And we've had sort of other universities, like private universities, like Kampala International University, UTAM, sort of pick a leaf from this and form research groups in artificial intelligence, this, you know, one small area of impact there. But I mean, there's been a lot of impact from Makerere, especially in computing, to other universities.
So particularly AI.
Particularly AI, yeah.
And machine learning. And you've been a significant part of that. So in terms of, I mean, tell us about your PhD work, because, you know, I think it's ongoing, that project, but I think it's a really nice example.
Right, so the aim was to sort of use local data sets to do a lot of inference and prediction mainly. So we started out looking at data, so all these statistics collected from the country, and trying to predict things like cholera. And then over time, this built up into, what about unique data sets like images for crop disease analysis? And this sort of a huge part of the PhD, it was new data, it was new sort of inference, it was a very interesting problem, a strong problem. We had very good collaborators in the agriculture space. And so we started building these models to do surveillance, crop surveillance, particularly cassava. So surveillance of disease and automated prediction or diagnosis of disease in the field.
So again, cassava is interesting. So my understanding of cassava, it's not widely eaten in Uganda. It's very popular in West Africa. But it's an important crop because it survives drought. So a lot of people have cassava planted, and if there's problems with then you go to the cassava. It's a staple, it's a starchy root vegetable, and you go to the cassava as a sort of backup option. So it's something that the country is very sensitive to if things go wrong. I mean, is that correct?
Yeah, it's a key food security crop, cassava. So it's a very important crop. And it has a unique characteristic that is sort of grown by sort of smallholder farmers. So this is a crop they'll definitely grow in combination with other crops because of that. So once things go bad, this is the crop they're going to go to. And now, you know, the government is sort of encouraging people to build other, you know, products from it. So they don't have to wait until things are bad, but they can build some other products and sort of improve their livelihoods through this crop. This is a very, very serious crop.
Your PhD, what years was it across again? It was
about 2007 I started the PhD.
So the other interesting thing about that era, and we heard speaking to Dina, of course, the mobile phone revolution was really coming through in force at this period. And I think that that's the sort of thing you started picking up on. I guess at the time, I mean, people didn't realize the extent to which smartphones... You can get a $60 smartphone now, basically, can't you?
You can.
A highly functional Android smartphone, and that's a total game changer for your sort of work, right?
Yeah, that was a brilliant game changer. So from my previous work, was sort of... before this, so the innovative ICT thing in health, we're using PDAs. And this was a very complicated tool, but it was tricky because you had to sort of maintain this tool. It It was very hard because people had to charge and we had to get solar
panels. So PDAs like pocket PC things, HP things and things like that, yeah?
Exactly. So when the phone started picking up, I mean, the phone was phenomenal because one of the key things about the phone is you sort of don't have to maintain the equipment. You don't have to charge it. You don't have to take care of the charging because the people automatically take care of this for you. So things like theft, charging, maintenance, and these sort of things. So it was a brilliant tool to leverage sort of technology over. And this was a game changer. So we started fashioning these things like, how do you diagnose crops in the field? Of course, you have a mobile phone. Farmers started getting mobile phones. This was technology that we, you know, we started thinking that line and we've sort of followed that line thought as the phone becomes ubiquitous, more or less.
So the old, I remember another part of this story, that the old crop surveys, they would take, was it 3 months in the field of driving around and then return department, the Ministry of Agriculture, and then compile the data?
Yeah. I mean, they sort of collected these surveillance maps, and the idea was to have some idea of the spread of disease or state of disease and state of health of crops in the country. But then from the time they collected this data on paper by sort of driving along drivable paths and sort of doing this random survey, it was almost 6-8 months when they produced a map, and by then, you know, they couldn't do much in terms of interventions. And then they sort of had to go back after 3 months after that. So it was a big problem and something which we immediately saw we could solve with a mobile phone very quickly.
But then you went beyond that. This is the thing I love about the AI group. I mean, not just satisfied with writing an app where people count the number of yellow leaves or whatever, and the whitefly work is kind of impressive and state of the art.
Right, and the whitefly work we're doing is sort of counting whiteflies on a leaf, and they can be in the order of several hundreds on a leaf.
So the whitefly are a vector for a lot of crop disease.
Correct. And this sort of came by accident because, so the first time we interfaced with the farmers, with the agriculture organization in Uganda, we had this automated sort of diagnosis up on the phone, and we thought this was really cool tech. And we go and present this to them, and they look at it and they're like, yeah, okay, that's really good, but, you know, there's a really, really nagging problem we have. And so they say, you know, we need to count these whiteflies, and we have to do it manually right now. So it's an infuriating task. So they have to count 5 leaves per plant, and they have to do 30 plants per plot. And, you know, if the order of magnitude of whiteflies on the leaf is in the hundreds, then by the time someone does one garden alone, they're almost running mad. And they have to do this very early in the morning. So the whitefly thing came almost naturally, and, you know, it was just welcomed. You know, this was a key problem they needed sorted.
This is interesting, with the challenge of deploying the technology in the field, and therefore the importance of talking to people. You envisage something in the lab. Wherever you are, you envisage a solution, and then you get there, and they're like, yeah, okay, but this is the real pain point.
Yeah, I mean, sitting in our lab, we thought, wow, taking images and doing automated diagnosis, this is going to blow their minds. And, you know, it did, but then the whitefly thing was just a problem that was pressing them, and they just needed to get that solved. Over time, we've sort of learned by, you know, working with the organization there that, you know, a lot of talking goes into getting the tech adopted. Unbelievable how you have to build the relationship. And it's been a very strong revelation to us, you know, because, you know, coming from the tech side, you're used to just sitting in the lab and getting a problem solved, looking at the accuracy. But the fact that you sort of have to go and talk to the actual farmers, talk to the people who use the
evangelize.
Yeah,
I think, and then also the issues of deploying on specific hardware. So you presented earlier in the conference. No, in fact, Martin was presenting your work, wasn't he? And people asked about the algorithm, and they're using Viola Jones. I was kind of excited. I didn't know you were using Viola Jones, which is this face detection algorithm, famous face detection, one of the first successes of machine learning. So it was deployed on cameras very widely for face detection. And but it's amazing. It just circles all. I mean, and you can find about it online. Actually, if you search for the AI group at Macquarie, you can see these projects and see what it's doing. It just circles all the whitefly. Gives a extremely quick count.
Yeah. By the time we started deploying this, that was the state of the art, I think, more or less. And
but it'll go on any hardware. That's the beauty of it.
Yeah, that's the beauty. You just have changed, you know.
The $60 phones don't have the best processors in them.
Yeah, they don't. And I mean, it's a really good, you know, technique to do this sort of thing, especially even iterating through different accuracy, you know, sort of cascades, or these different files you have to put on the phone and make sure it can sort of run this thing in an accurate manner.
So I'm curious, I remember early days, I think we were using OpenCV on, is that right?
Right.
So that's a really great tool. I mean, has that been changing? Have you seen changes with sort of the, is the deep learning revolution affecting things sort of here in the field in Africa as much as it is elsewhere? Because Viola Jones clearly was the right choice, probably still is the right choice, but are there other areas where you see that coming through?
I mean, we're also transitioning to deep learning, you know. So the OpenCV, yeah, we use OpenCV and we still use it quite a bit. Particularly because it had all these sort of libraries you could put on the Android phone. But, you know, deep learning now with TensorFlow, you can sort of deploy quickly on the phone. We're sort of moving in that direction right now. The same reasons that everyone's moving that direction. You have better accuracy, you have ease of deployment right now on the phone. So it's quite the thing.
Yeah. I just pulled you out of the Internet of Things session in Data Science Africa. That's another interesting area. How do you see that coming into these projects? Because on the one hand, it's like, well, they've got phones, we can just do this stuff. Is this a return to a bit more what you were talking about in the sort of health analytics period, where you're going to have some exclusive hardware? And where do you see that acting, and where do you see the new challenges being?
So the challenge, I think I see opportunities for this Internet of Things. A key challenge is sort of getting good sensors deployed where we can pick good data. In agriculture, that's sort of on the farms, on the fields where the farmers are. And I think the IoT thing is really, I think that would be the way to do it. Because the mobile phone has sort of been our sensor for a long time. And for some of the projects we are doing, like surveillance, we rely on the farmer to sort of go and take an image, for example, or take some data from the field. But, you know, if we have a very cheap sensor which can be powered, you know, by a very small battery for a very long time, this is something that can be quickly deployed in the
field. Yeah, I mean, I thought that was one of the things that Jan's session on, you know, he's talking about this Nucleo board that it's a development board that people are using, and I can't remember, was it a 6-year battery life from a AA battery on this thing under certain operating conditions, obviously.
Yeah.
And that's with an ability to connect either to a mobile phone or something else on occasion, so to be woken up. It's an extraordinary thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, yeah, I kept thinking of sort of the applications. I mean, one of the things you talked about was this 10-kilometer range short communication with these sensors that can sort of last for 6 years on 1A. You know, AA battery.
So that sensor is like placed across field, AA battery, 10-kilometer range for communication amongst the sensor network.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting challenges that I think were brought up in one of the questions. Afrosoft, the guy from Afrosoft, who I haven't had a chance to speak to in detail yet, but this leads to challenges with data again, doesn't it? And then it all comes back to how you pull all this data in and process. And so it feels like, you know, the attendees are loving the Internet of Things session. It's like the most popular session. Everyone's building temperature sensors, moisture sensors, and as I think you were saying on the walk across, they all now want to do projects on it.
Yeah.
And we're going to get ourselves in a data mess, aren't we?
I mean, yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're putting sensors in their mouths and their, you know, all sorts of things so they actually work. It's quite interesting. Yeah, I think the exposure is going to be amazing. I mean, I sort of see the next Data Science Africa workshop, people coming with all sorts of projects or experience from projects they've done, from sort of the IoT stuff they're learning right now. And
I'd love to move to getting the analysis thing, because I just get the sense, looking at the way people are responding, they're going to do that. They're going to do that on their own. You know, like they're like kids with toys. They've been shown a toy. You know, these things cost $20 and they're all going to want more of the toy. But then probably we need to think a little bit ahead a bit, and what skill sets they need that perhaps aren't the glittery thing. And maybe next year doing sessions around how to upload and analyze that data, how to do the data management from the ground up. Because you know that people get themselves in a mess because they'll deploy the sensors and they won't have the data management side in order, which I'm imagining is probably a big issue, I mean, for the cassava work.
Yeah, I mean, deployment alone is quite a big deal. I mean, even just deploying the sensors. I mean, right now we can sort of test them in a lab. But, you know, deploying them and reliably getting the data and sort of maintaining that and doing the analytics, I think that's going to be... But I mean, it's a key step that they sort of get exposed the first time. So I think next round, definitely, we should do more analytics on the data. It'd be a good experience to see what they have sort of done with the data, or how they've deployed them.
Well, actually, I'm really curious about the workshop next couple of days, because I'm suspecting to see advances in the sort of things people are getting up to already. Mm-hmm. So we're teaching this to the students, basically, but then we're going to see the experts coming in from different places over the next few days, and we'll start getting a sense of the imaginative things people have got up to in the field.
Yeah, and it's a good mix. I mean, there's some groups which are going to present, which are sort of startup groups. Some of them came last year. There's a group here that sort of came last year. They sort of did something with the cassava data we had. They won an award with MTN Uganda, so they're sort of funding this startup that they're going to have. So it's quite interesting to see that, you know, they can actually take the lessons, get some projects done, take them to some sort of scale. Now they're going to form some startup.
The startup culture is a really interesting thing because, in some sense, that's the obvious next step. I mean, actually, you don't want to rely on universities to be delivering all this stuff. It doesn't scale, you know, in that sense. You can't address all the applications. You want these to be exemplars that inspire people, inspire students to go out there in the real world. How do you think that's developing in Kampala in particular?
I mean, it's developing quite well. I mean, we've got a lot of interest sort of in the AI and data science lab right now. Students coming in and wanting to do projects that they could sort of take to the field and form companies. So the fact that there's less employment sort of makes people more innovative.
Yeah.
And so they're sort of looking for all ways. And I think this culture of sort of using their computing skills to build these startups is growing. Kampala is growing. There are many startups, like the data John showed with the Boda Bodas, this group that came out of...
So Boda Bodas, they're like motorbike taxis.
The motorbike.
Are the major way of getting around Kampala, if you're brave.
Yeah. Well, if you're in Kampala and you stay more than a week, you know, then you have enough courage to take them. Yeah, so these guys, they came out of our college and they sort of touched these sensors on the Boda Bodas and they're actually making a lot of money out of it, so they sort of track theft of borders.
Ah, yes.
It's done. Most of the borders are rented out to the buyer, and then they have to pay back. So if it gets stolen midway, then it's a big problem. So these border guys sort of come and register on this system, pay some small token fee per month, and...
That's a lot of the themes of the projects that most interest me are you're looking at people who are on the edge in terms of their work, that if anything goes wrong, bodas stolen, they have an accident, they have an injury or anything like this, they just get pushed over into a precipice. Anything that can help with that is so massively leveraged. I mean, it really makes a big difference.
Yeah, it does. I mean, even the smaller farmers sort of try and... do all the work we're doing for, you know, they need quick diagnosis in the field because, you know, if the guy doesn't see the disease and sort of goes on, then the crop dies and this.
And you know, coming back to that, so the data you have is feeding spatial models. Then you can preemptively predict where the disease is moving to next. You advise to change. It's typical a breed change advice. It's not typically pesticides, is it, in this case?
So the things that move the disease most are sort of people planting the wrong sort of variety.
Mm.
I see. You definitely want to make sure that doing the plant the right variety first of all, and then.
And is that data you can get? Can you classify the variety when your data is coming in?
So that's data that the National Agriculture Organization wants, the sort of the body in Uganda that's looking at this. So we've been collecting a lot of data on leaf data, leaf images, and from this you can then get the spatial understanding of disease in the country, and I've sort of been telling us we need to get the variety data. So the variety data is very complex. That's just another problem we've sort of been thinking about. So the farmers down there do not know which varieties they have, and the people up here also do not know exactly which varieties are being grown down. So it's we've sort of thought about it as an image, computer vision problem.
Mm.
So we're trying to sort of characterize it and see if we can get that done as well. But it's something which is definitely on the agenda of the agriculture organization in Uganda.
So what next? What do you see happening? I mean, these projects are getting mature. They're providing such inspiration for so many people here. I mean, Dina was saying, oh, it's great to have, you know, Neil and Ralph here. And I think, yeah, well, you know, I love being here too. But in some sense, it's not relatable to people. I have all these things I could do and go out and deploy. People can't relate to that. But they can relate to you growing up in the same environment and being successful and delivering solutions. I think that's far more inspiring. I find it enormously inspiring. because the challenges were actually that much greater. I mean, talking to like Shira about just trying to get in a PhD. And I know how universities react. You know, you get emails from Africa, oh, I want to do a PhD. Yeah, yeah, whatever. All those challenges. But people seeing that it can be done, and the Netherlands has been really great on this. Groningen, isn't it?
Yeah, did Groningen. Your PhD.
And there's an ongoing program there with Michael Beale and... Well-qualified PhDs is what feeds the system, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, looking at all the... I mean, that was a very significant project that we sort of talked about earlier on, sort of having Barrier get all these PhDs, and you put them in one faculty, you know, even something's going to happen. You know, something's going to happen. And it also helps, you know, to cultivate these local solutions, as you said. Yeah. It's very important. There's also a micro local level. So while we are in Kampala, you know, even when we go down to the field, to the rural areas, sort of interact with the farmers, we also have to get another level of sort of farmer groups or key farmers, model farmers that have to sort of deploy the solution downwards. So it's a whole cascade of, you know, making sure the context is right. That
the same reasons. Like, it's all the same thing, isn't it? It's like, you know, the farmer can't relate to the guy at Makerere University that has made an app. I mean, so he has to have a trusted friend that says, oh, this is great, and this is how you do it, and this is what makes it work. And then they can relate to that, right?
Yeah. I mean, we've found that building relationships is a big, big part of sort of making sure tech is delivered downwards. So what we're doing right now, one of the systems we're doing right now is sort of this ad hoc surveillance. So getting farmers and people down in the rural areas to send up data, send images actually, because that's the simplest way they can sort of collect data. They don't need much. They basically take an image, it sort of classifies on the phone, if they're a farmer, you know, maybe this disease, and then the image goes up. And then from this, you can sort of build spatial models. And we're getting a lot of... just understanding the social dynamics of who sends data, how much they send, what are the incentives to sort of engage in this system.
There's so many areas where Africa is ahead. And the incentivization structure for data acquisition in these domains, the thinking here is so much further ahead. Kudu is one I often think of. I think I mentioned it in a previous interview. The project John was working on distributing, you know, getting bids in for maize on trucks before the trucks are delivered. These incentivization structures to get people either involved or, you know, do you give them money or do you give them benefits? I know you've looked at that an enormous amount. And also the right farmers, because certain farmers will engage, particularly a certain age, I suspect, but then you miss vast areas.
We've done this for sort of 1 year and it's been quite a learning experience. So all things matter, so age, gender. We've tried all sorts of incentives, so the recognition, sending them small data airtime. We've tried small token micropayments to sort of get them to send the data. We've tried, you know, sort of Eastern Christmas bonanzas, you know, send data and you know, and everything. And, you know, you sort of get this very mixed sort of way in which they respond to these incentives. It's been quite an experiment, and want to actually grow this and sort of try with the youth groups. So the youth are one of the big sort of bodies in Uganda that is a very hard group to sort of peg down. Because we have majority of the people are sort of in the youth bracket right now. And so there's been a lot of talk from the government to sort of engage these people. And we kept thinking, you know, I mean, these would be the guys who... He has a mobile phone, he can sort of move around.
A mobile phone and a bicycle.
On a bicycle, and he can take photos as he moves around. They look like a key sort of ally and want to try this out, want to see if they can actually do this and we can collect some, you know, data that makes sense for surveillance. That'd be really great.
Because it used to be just the bicycle. I'm just thinking about that. It used to be like if you had the bicycle, that was it. You were in, you could take... I mean, people use their bikes for extraordinary things. But now it is. It's kind of like the mobile phone plus the bicycle, and you're like a little information gathering.
Yeah. Bicycle and mobile phone. It used to be bicycle and radio. Now it's bicycle.
Yeah, bicycle and radio. Yeah,
stroke
yeah.
radio. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, those are little things. For example, you have to give them a phone with a radio. That's important.
So, of course, John... was at Makerere, and now he's moved on to the Pulse Lab, but that's opened up a lot of opportunities around access to data and things like that.
Yeah, it has been really, really great. I mean, the UN Pulse Lab, of course, with all the connections and the ability to sort of reach, especially the government data.
Government data.
Yeah,
government. They're very close to the Department of Health. They're a trusted organization by a lot of governments.
It's been a little.
And they can also, the other thing they do, which is so important, is that they can take a solution that's been deployed in one country and they can transfer it very easily. Certainly around, for example, health data, which I worked with John on for a period where we couldn't get access and it wasn't working. As soon as he moved into Global Pulse, then that started working. And I think the intention is to ship that out beyond Uganda as well.
I mean,
the labs have benefited quite a bit. I mean, we've also for a while been trying to get that health data. And, you know, with the Pulse Lab, it's been...
Because you're now they're subcontracting quite a lot to the AI.
Yeah.
Which I just love because it just feels like a robust system. And one of the things that fascinates me about Kampala when I first went is John described, and everyone, and Martin, and probably you have all these interests beyond just the academic role. And Shira was saying, oh, I've got a small holding now, I've got a farm. Everyone diversifies because in uncertainty, you need to be diverse. You need to have a robust network. And building these sort of little systems, I think it's an African way of doing it. It's about contacts. It's something that will be robust. Things will go wrong. We know things can be turbulent, but hopefully all this survives those moments.
Right. You have to have a side hustle. That's always the thing in Kampala. So it's been good. I mean, having a side hustle, which is a data science project, that's fantastic. So, you know, the UN Global Pulse Lab has really been good at that. So creating these opportunities, you know, transferring, contracting work down to the lab, it's quite good. I mean, you also get an exposure from, not only from the academic side of things, but, you know, you have... A scale out you have to do. You have to scale out certain projects. You have to build certain visualizations or processing of data. So
you bring good. Data to the decision makers, and that's exactly. You take it from the farmers and you bring it to the decision makers. I mean, and that's a whole other set of problems with many similarities.
Very, very, very similarities. Yeah,
one's a decision maker, one's a farmer, but the way you address it is the same. Yeah,
exactly the same. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
But it's been good to have the connections, I think that's the... And, of course, through the data, you know, the Data Science Africa, now we're having connections with for example, Dekut, with Shira.
I'm going
to visit
Ernest
him,
Mbaze,
I think,
of Makerere University in Kampala. And it was just fascinating to hear him talk about what he's working
Nelson
on
Mandela
these days.
As I said before Dina's interview, I met Ernest with John in Augstool. I mean, the work he's doing is just extraordinary. One of the things I loved about Ernest's interview is, you know, he goes out into the field, he talks to the farmers, and then he goes back and he talks to decision makers in the Ministry of Agriculture. I love the duality of that, that you have to get in the mindset of both. The skill set you need to do that is the same, but he also has to do the skill set of building the thing in between. So few people are talking to customers, and you know, the point he was making around what they decided to build before they went out to the farm,
right.
And then what they decided to build after they went out to the farm. That is so important.
Yeah.
What you believe that you need to do sitting inside one place is very different from what is actually required in the field. And I think that that's why it's so important that we've got teams like Ernest's deploying these solutions on site. Because, you know, to be frank, I've heard it said that the way to build a successful app is to write an app that does something your mother used to do for you.
Used to do for you, yeah.
But the things that your mother used to do for you, that may also be true in Kampala. But the things your mother may have done for you in Kampala would be very different
from
the things
that
they do in San Francisco, which is like drive you around or, you know, book your dinner reservation or whatever else. The problem sets are different. And, you know... It just does not work to sort of sit there without talking to people on the ground. You know, even for Ernest, who has been in Kampala, you know, who's grown up there his entire life, did his PhD in Netherlands, it doesn't work for him to decide what a farmer in Kampala needs or what an agricultural inspector needs. He actually has to go out there and speak to them. And that's a repeated pattern. That's a repeated pattern across so many applications. If you want to do something successfully, understand the domain first and the machine learning second. It's probably... heresy for talking machines. But it's something I kind of believe.
Well, how are you going to approach the data clearly if you don't have some idea of how it was collected or what was important or why those decisions were made? It seems
you can't build your model.
Right.
Yeah,
you can't.
Yeah. There's this wonderful quote from George Box. The original one is all models are wrong, but some are useful, which is a bit overused. But in the same paper, there's this wonderful quote. I can't remember the precise form of it. It's important to be worried about the nature in which it's wrong. You shouldn't worry about mice when there are tigers abroad. Meaning, don't worry about the minutiae of why your model's wrong when it's wrong in some major way. Now, to understand the difference between a mice and tiger, you actually have to go into the field and look at the damn things and what they can do. That quote is super important in modeling. That's it from a statistics point of view, but it applies equally to anyone doing data science or machine learning.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that's it for us on this episode of Talking Machines. I'm Catherine Gorman.
And I'm Neil Lawrence.
Tune in next episode.